That had stopped after the children of Israel had gone off into captivity. They came back and the idol was cut off among the land. But yet idolatry was prevalent, and it's kind of difficult for us as Christians to wrap our minds around idolatry, someone that would have a trinket or a fixture or an image, some kind of idol made out of either some metal or some piece of wood of which you're trying to worship and regard some higher power. And so they actually had temples in the city of Corinth that would be dedicated to these idols. People would bring them meat to be offered to them. We don't do animal sacrifices today. They were still doing animal sacrifices in the first century. I believe that you would find, if you went to the uttermost parts of the earth today, in some tribal regions of third world countries, you'd probably find some idolatry taking place. You might find some animal sacrifices taking place. What I do hear about is this. So those who have gone to a part of Africa have found witchcraft. They do a lot of this sort of thing with witchcraft. What they're doing is that they're trying to propagate this idea of a higher power, something that can be pulled in by the powers of men, and idolatry is somewhat akin to that. Idolatry in Colorado Springs, though, we don't see that per se. We don't see somebody worshiping some type of image. I don't see that. But what we do see is that in the New Testament that covetousness is called idolatry. You can make an idol out of possessions. You can make an idol out of money itself. You can make an idol out of anything that's of earth. You can make an idol of anything that's in the heavenly realm. We're talking about space. You can make an idol of relationships, either with humans or with animals. You can make idols out of those. And so a lot of this world is godless, but yet their affections are focused on these things of which we could, in a scriptural sense, call idols. And so what it comes down to is this. Should we worship an idol? The answer is no. So it was frequent in Corinth and in the United States, especially here. It would be prohibited. It was prohibited in the first century. If you were to talk to a Jew and you were to say, "Shall you worship idols?" the Jew would say, "No, don't worship an idol." Jews knew not to worship idols, but Gentiles had that in their culture. They had it in their civilization and communities, and yet it's forbidden. A couple of chapters over, and we're not going to use this too much, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 14, where he says, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, flee idolatry." So at that point, he's telling them to be sure that they're not worshiping an idol or doing anything that's going to give them a participation, a fellowship with that which is called idolatry. You don't want to be accused of, by God, of putting something else before him. Don't be guilty of idolatry. Then we continue the flow here in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. A few observations about those first six verses of which I read. The next of which is, eating meats which were offered idols is not always a sin. So again, in that marketplace, you would buy meat, and for us, we go to King Super, wherever we want to go, and we buy meat. We don't ask the question, was this offered to an idol? And then in a secondary use of the same meat, was it then brought here so that we could put it out on the barbecue? We don't ask that question. Back then, it would have been a normal thing, a common thing. And somebody says, well, if that meat has ever been offered to an idol, we shouldn't eat it because we're going to be participating with the idol. And he's saying it's not always a sin. And that is sort of baffling, but here we have some of the reasons why. The first of which is there's no such thing as a god. He calls them so-called gods. There's really no such thing as an idol. Don't be afraid of these gods. I like the Old Testament sense in which you see oftentimes that idols, when they were called upon to respond, such as Elijah or with the time of Gideon, if an idol's mad about something, let him speak up for himself. And of course, in any case of which that were, tested, idols couldn't speak up for themselves. And the reason being is there's no such idol. They don't really exist. They've been constructed by the minds of men, and then, of course, they use that to control other people. And they themselves serve these idols so that men might have their own affections. And so that's what he says. In verse 4, he says, "Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there's no other god but one. For even if there are so-called gods," so-called he calls them in verse 5, "whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and the Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. So there's not really even an idol that exists. There is only one God, of which we just read, and then all that is in the world is from Jehovah God and belongs to him. This is also stated in Psalm 24, verse 1, that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. In other words, you can't touch anything of which God can't call it back. God says, that's mine. So any of this meat which might be found in the marketplace, somebody says, well, that was meat that was offered to the idol. It doesn't belong to the idol. It belongs to God. It belongs to God. Now, as we stop this section, something that I want you to remind yourself of is the second point on the chart. Fellowship with idols or sacrifice to idols is always sinful. So somebody says, what difference does it make what you do? It does make a difference. If you're going to fellowship the idol, that's sinful. If you're going to sacrifice to the idol, that is sinful. If you go and eat and you partake of that, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says that those who partake of the meats that were offered unto Jehovah God would be the priest. He says as they ate of those meats, they were partaking of what God is about. They actually partake of their relationship with God. They're partaking of what God is about. Back when they did the original Passover, they were told to consume all the lamb that they would offer. What that meant was if they consumed it all, it meant that they were participating. They were buying into everything that God was about. And in that case, it was going to be their deliverance from Egypt out of that bondage and send them on their way to the promised land. Everything of which God was about, if they consumed that sacrifice, they were partaking of God. That's what they were doing. He says, don't partake of idols. Do not partake of idols. So somebody says, it doesn't matter what you do. Everything belongs to God. It does matter what you do. It matters what you do. And things can be put in the wrong context, and when they are in the wrong context, they become evil. So I wanted to clarify that before we go to slide two. So any meats offered to idols may be sinful. May be sinful. So we start here again. 1 Corinthians chapter, we'll start in chapter 8 before we go to chapter 10 to look at the cross-reference. But what he says here in verse 7, however, there is not in everyone that knowledge, for some with conscience of the idol until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. Verse 8, but food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. So the idea that I said that I put in there two different categories that we need to consider. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he says, you've got a brother in Christ. This is a Christian. And he believes that if he eats that meat, even though God says no such thing as idols, he believes that he's actually participating. He's partaking of that idol. He says, what you're doing is you're affecting another Christian. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he regards the affecting of another who would be an unbeliever. So as you start there in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 14, he says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. He says, I speak as to wise men, judge for yourselves what I say. And when he speaks of idolatry, wanting to be sure that we don't have any kind of fellowship with those who are idolatrous, and of course we're not having fellowship with the idol, but the regard here seems to be that you're having an impact on somebody that's an unbeliever. And so the unbeliever would be someone that's not even practicing any service unto God whatsoever, but they see you, in this case, eating meat that was offered to an idol, they might just assume that you believe in the idol because you're eating meat that's offered to an idol. We're not going to go into that, but that's what chapter 10 is about. We'll save that for later. What we're concerned about here in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 is the effect that we have on a fellow Christian, another person who is a believer. So one's knowledge of meats and idols may not be the same as a fellow Christian's knowledge. I may have full approval in my conscience, but another may not. The word that is used here is weak. It's not only used here in 1 Corinthians, it's also used in Romans when the Apostle Paul talks about eating meat versus just eating vegetables. And he says, you have someone who has a weak knowledge or a weak conscience. We need to be careful about that. The word weak is ambiguous. The word weak has to be contextual. And so here's the way that I would like you to think about it. First off, I don't believe that he's talking about those who are weak in spiritual strength. Spiritual strength regards closeness to God, a strong faith. This is a person that says, I'm going to stand with God. I'm not going to conform to the world. This is a person that says, I trust God more than I trust myself. I will hold to God more than I will serve my own mind or my body. That's a strong faith. So anyone in that spectrum of those who would be strong in spiritual strength may have varying degrees of knowledge and conscience in regard, he said, to eating these meats that may have been offered to an idol. And so that's not the point here. When we think of the word weak, it's not someone that's weakly. It's somebody that has less knowledge, less conscience about something that they're going to do. Also, it's not weak in intelligence. I read one commentary where they said these people just weren't advanced very much as far as their intelligence. In other words, these are kind of backward people. And so we look at them. I like what Romans 14 says, don't despise the person that will not eat. You're like, well, someday they'll grow up. We just have to feel sorry for them. That's not the concept. It's not someone that's weak in intelligence. Intelligence is not the issue here. Again, the concept is this is a person that with everything that he's got, he wants to please the Lord. He wants to stand right before the Lord. It's not a matter of his intelligence, because you can have someone with great intelligence. If you look at the very first verse, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1, he says, now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. The concept is this, that intelligence is not the issue. Intelligence might even hurt you more than it helps you. We'll talk about that in just a moment. This is a person that's not weak in all issues. Not all issues. It's just this one area. So in other areas of life, this person might be more advanced in knowledge. This person might be more advanced in confidence. So when it comes to different issues of life, one might have stronger confidence and conscience in one area than another person does, and they might take turns being strong and weak in that regard. I don't know how much you know about mules. Does anybody here have any experience with mules? This is great. Nobody does. Okay, I'll still give you an analogy. I think you can get it. All right, the idea of a mule is that he's stubborn, that he comes to some type of obstacle, and the mule just won't move. And so I have a friend, he has several mules, and he's, in fact, I've got two friends with mules, okay? So I'm getting overloaded with a mule association here. But what they showed me was a video where they actually have high jumping contests for mules, okay? And so it tells you a little bit about the psychology of a mule, and you're thinking a mule is just stubborn. He's decided he doesn't want to do something, he won't do it. And I've made the expression that I've never met a mule as stubborn as some men can be, okay? But because we usually reverse it, say as stubborn as a mule. But actually what they do is this, that they'll have a fence. And so the rider, he stops, gets off. The mule won't go over the fence, but mules are good at jumping. They do. They jump obstacles really well. In fact, if you're not ready to jump, and I've done this. I've ridden on a mule. One of my friends puts me on a mule, and we're going up through the mountains, okay? And there's a log that's sort of over the trail. The log's only about 2 feet high. And I'm thinking, okay, mule's going to stop. I'll get off. We'll lead the mule around. The mule just darts over it like that. There's about this much daylight between me and the saddle, okay? But I stay on. Somehow or another, I stay on. I'm like, wow, the mule had confidence there. But they bring the mule up to the obstacle, to the fence, and what the rider does, he gets off and he throws his jacket over the fence. The mule jumps over the fence. And so they actually have high jumping contests for mules. But if the mule doesn't have confidence, all of a sudden what locks in? That stubbornness, right? You can't force a mule to go beyond its comfort level, its confidence level. It will not happen. And so I'm thinking that mules have had a bad rap all these years, maybe all these centuries, right? Because men wanted mules to do something of which the mule found some hesitation and doesn't have a confidence level. We can learn from the mule just like we learn from ants, insects, other animals, and so forth. The Bible uses all kinds of analogies. When you force a person to go by beyond that which he has a conscience for, that's a violation before the Lord. That's a violation before the Lord. And you can shame the person into going against their conscience. You can rebuke them. you can chastise them, even punish them, break your conscience. And in this case, he says, what you're doing is you're trying to force a person to come around to what you're thinking is. He says, that's not good. That is not right. If a person has a prohibition, any prohibition, even something that may be right within its own context, but he still has a conscience against those things, it's wrong for us to push that person beyond that. That's a violation of love. So we go to the next point on this slide. That is, this knowledge without love for the weak is arrogance. Now, my translation here, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1, he says, now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. Some translations there say that knowledge is arrogant. It's arrogant. The word is arrogant. In other words, I'm thinking academically, I've measured this subject up, and then I've concluded that eating meats offered to idols is no problem. Everybody else ought to grow up like I did. He says, all of a sudden, in the absence of love, he says, I have arrogance. Now what I'm doing is I'm destroying rather than building someone up. Whereas love, he says, love edifies. Verse 2, and if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing, yet as he ought to know. Someone says, well, I would just wish everybody was as smart as I am. He says, all of a sudden, you're not so smart because you haven't taken into consideration everything of which is involved. What's involved primarily, and I appreciate this with the recent gospel meeting we had with Brother Tom Hamilton. He says, what's involved primarily is relationship with God, relationship with others. And when we reduce something to just an academic topic of which relies upon our own knowledge, we've missed it. We've totally missed it. And that's what he's saying here, verse 3. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Then what does it do? It's useful to all. And it shows one's relationship with God. As we advance into the passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 7 beginning, I make the point that we must value relationship with God and the value of souls more than we value food. And food's very enticing. God made the food. But yet, our relationship with God, how we value other souls, is more important. I'll read verse 7 again. He says, however, there is not in everyone that knowledge. For some with conscience of the idol until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol. And their conscience being weak is defiled. So he's saying this, stop. Before you eat, stop. Someone says, well, there's nothing wrong with this food. In fact, God made it. Everything belongs to God. There's no such thing as gods or idols. Eat it. And if this person doesn't know what's going on, too bad for them. He says, you need to think about that other person. This might be a case where I need to be my brother's keeper. He says, but food does not commend us to God. For neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. So food does not commend us to God. So we think sometimes how important something is. He says, does it get you closer to God? Does it commend you to God? Will God approve you? You went and ate some food. Therefore, God says, you are closer to me. You are more blessed than others because you have eaten food. He says, no. So how much do we value food? He's telling us to condition ourselves. Food cannot cause one for whom Christ died, or it can cause one for whom Christ died to be lost. So we advance our reading again when we see in verse 9. He says, but beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. That same statement was made in Romans chapter 14. It says, don't destroy somebody for whom Christ died. That really weighs heavy on me. I don't want to be the reason that somebody else loses their soul. First off, God valued them. If you've read Matthew chapter 18, and you see in Matthew chapter 18 that a sheep is lost, a shepherd leaves 99 sheep to go get one sheep to recover that one that is lost. That's how valuable everyone is to the Lord. And so when we see that some brother is not walking in strength, and we're thinking, too bad, we'll miss him, he says, you haven't valued that brother enough. When we're seeing a fellow Christian and we're saying, doesn't matter what I do, he has to answer to the Lord for himself. I don't care what I do. His own walk is his business. If I eat meat offered to an idol, regardless of whatever my conduct and activity is, and I'm kind of just oblivious to whatever his thoughts are, he says, if that's the way you live, he says, you could offend that brother. The word offend means cause him to sin. That's not just hurt his feelings, as today's idea of the word offend is. You actually cause this brother or sister so that they violate their conscience because you've not been mindful of them and their thought process. He's telling us that we really need to be mindful of other people. And the reason being that this is one for whom Christ died. We cause this one to be lost. He calls it a liberty. So he calls it a liberty. We live in a society of entitlement. Everything's our right. We have the right to equal rights, equal pay. And it goes down the list. And somebody says, I've got my rights. And so all of a sudden he says, no, this is not a right. This is a liberty. This is a freedom. That means that there's going to be a choice that I have to make. And in every instance, it's not the right choice. It's a liberty. And so it could be that I could eat that meat because it's not going to cause some other Christian to have a problem. I can eat this meat because everybody that's around me is of full knowledge and also believes the same thing. But he says, if it comes to the point of which I'm going to entice somebody else to sin against the Lord, to stumble, this is a case of which I'm not going to eat. That's the case in which it's a liberty. It's a freedom. Do not misuse a freedom. And then this. Food must not or must be withheld from us, he says, if it causes one to stumble, even if it means I'm never going to eat meat again. This really is what we would call strict, and we are restricting from ourselves for the rest of our life if this would be the case. So I start in verse 13. He says, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. Here's a person that says, I wouldn't want a single person lost if I were to eat this meat. Not a single person. And you're saying, wait a minute. This kind of punishes a guy. It punishes a man or a woman that's a Christian because now they've got to go the rest of their life in a city like Corinth and just eat vegetables. I guess they weren't offering vegetables to the idols. And that's the way it's going to be. He says, if that's the way it's going to be, that's the way it's going to be. But this is my commitment to God. That's what the Apostle Paul has said, saying in this case. You look at some of this and you're saying, that's commitment. That's quite a commitment to the Lord. I was looking at a parallel in Acts chapter 16, and this is not on the slide, but when it came to the Apostle Paul and he was inviting Timothy, maybe even commanding him to go along with him in preaching the gospel of Christ, he required that he would be circumcised. And saying, wait a minute, you can't require someone to have surgery so that they can do the work of the gospel. Timothy had the surgery. He did have the surgery. That's commitment. Just commitment. You're saying why? It's because he wasn't going to get in the doors of any of the Jewish folks if he didn't have circumcision. That's commitment. And so no matter what you would be required to do, you say, I really want to be mindful of others. I will do that. And so I give you some things of which we list, and I'm sorry to use the word list, but it's a list. A list of conclusions. This is how this progressed in my mind. So first off, that which is prohibited is always sinful, such as idolatry. Knowledge may improve one's conscience, that which is not prohibited. So it's not prohibited to eat meat or eating meats offered to idols. You can have that knowledge. The third item is this. That which is permissible to me may cause another to sin simply because they violated their conscience. Conscience is so important in this whole theme. Conscience is something that God gives us so that it protects us and it helps us keep our hearts pure before the Lord. We must not cause another to sin. The fourth item, knowledge must be ruled by love. If we throw out love, then knowledge is just arrogance. The fifth thing, if that which is permissible causes another to violate their conscience, it's not one's right. Someone says, it's my right. If they don't like it, it's their problem. If they say it's their problem, it's not my right. Finally, this. Destroying another's conscience results in my sin against Christ. So that's compounded. The last 2 points is, first, I've sinned against the other person, but then he says, you've also sinned against Christ. You've sinned against Christ in this. So, in all of this, concerning things offered to idols, the Apostle Paul is helping us so that we know that we have conditions which are sometimes variable, and we have to make these kinds of decisions. I take these concluding points. If you want to copy this list or want to photocopy it or whatever, you could do that. I believe the Apostle Paul is saying, in whatever environment that you live, if it be in Africa or if it be in Colorado Springs, and you're trying to decide how that you're going to make decisions that are going to affect yourself, keeping yourself from sin, but also affecting your relationship and your influence before others, I believe these are the principles that are involved. It's not just regarding meats offered to idols. I'm through preaching now.